No state moves water around the way California moves water around. The water that would normally stay in the Owens Valley keeps Los Angeles green. Water from the Trinity River that would naturally end up in the Klamath is diverted, some of it, into the Sacramento River system. There are many stories like that in a state that is number one in making food and something like number 41 in average annual precipitation. California native Mark Arix tells stories about waters and farms and people in a new book called The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. Mark Arix writes about California and the West, long and short form. He's a former LA Times staffer and the author of several previous books, including The King of California, which won several awards. Mark Arix, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Jeff, good to be with you there in Ashland, one of my favorite spots on the map. I was just driving through the smoky hills of southern Oregon about 2 weeks ago.
That was pretty much our only smoke episode so far this summer. You had bad timing.
Yeah, no, I timed it just perfectly.
Right. So your previous book that we mentioned, The King of California, was about a cotton magnate who drained a lake, among other things. Did opening that can of worms lead to the worm buffet that is The Dreamt Land?
It did in a strange way. I vowed after that book never to write about water again.
Oops.
And the drought. I broke that vow during this last drought. I mean, just, I was trying to understand. All my books are an attempt to understand California. That The King of California, we had a lake not far from where I live in Fresno. It was called Tulare Lake. It was the most dominant feature on the California map. And this was before the rivers were dammed. And that lake would show up from the snow melt, and it just disappeared. And that was the story of how the cotton plantation from the South, these plantation owners were chased out of the South by the boll weevil in the 1900s. They came west and started a new cotton plantation here. I could never figure out why my middle of California felt more South than it did like California. And that explained it to me, that story. And so this one kind of grew out of that one. Both big fat books telling the story of a place.
So other people have written about California's unslakable thirst. What did you do differently?
I really got into the stories. I tried to write it in a literary way, almost like a novel. And you can read the critics. They're saying it's one of the most definitive books, most important books written about California in a generation. So it's really digging deep into the land, coming at it from the perspective of a native. The insight that gives you, the blindness that it also entails. Because sometimes when you're living here, you don't see things like an outsider, so you have to, you have to remind yourself that your eye can become almost callous to what's going on. But there was something happening on the land in 2014 that I couldn't understand. The national media was telling the story of how California was drying up, and that the middle of California, the most extensive and intensive farming experiment in the world. That there was a dust bowl going on. Yes, some of the smaller farmers were fallowing land, and they were doing all they could to get through drought. But the bigger guys were actually growing and more. And so coming out of drought, agriculture actually expanded. More nuts, more almonds, more pistachios, more mandarin oranges. And I couldn't figure that out. How could that be? That in the midst of no water, they were growing.
That's a huge question. I remember thinking about it at the time, too, as I drove through California and thought, wait, there are more nut trees than there used to be. Why are people planting nut trees, which are voracious users of water, in a drought?
Well, any food you grow is going to be a voracious user of water. So if you're a farm belt, no matter what you grow, the almond became the bad guy in the drought, but the legume could have been the bad guy in the drought. The cow could have been the bad guy in the drought. It's whatever one you want to pick. Growing crops, it requires a lot of water. So what the book begins with this kind of mystery, and And then it tells the story of the invention of California and the reinvention. So let's start at the beginning, the proposition of California itself. We take this landmass, it's 1,000 miles long, and we decide that we're going to draw one line around it. We're going to call it one state. The problem is that state has maybe a dozen different states of nature inside it. So on the extreme end, up where you're at, you know, the rain falls, in some cases, 150 inches a year. Down in San Diego, the Imperial Valley, it falls 5 inches a year. And what we decide to do is we're going to even out those differences. I mean, it's an incredible act of hubris, but we're going to even out those. And so to invent California, we have to invent the grandest water-moving project in the history of man. And we do it. I mean, it's a magnificent system we built. The Central Valley Project in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and then the State Water Project after that. And we literally moved the rain. We created 2, if not 3, world-class cities, and we created this farm belt in the middle that has no parallel. But the system is cracking. In the life of that system, the population of California has gone from 11 million to 40 million. And that system, as magnificent as it is not going to see us into a future of more houses across the desert and more nut trees across the fertile middle. Something has to give. And so it's into those cracks I go as a writer, and I spend 5 years trying to puzzle out the beginning of California, the reinventions of California, and where we're headed today.
So talk about what's going on at the beginning of the book, your pal Brad Gleason and his nut trees in 2014.
So all my books start close at home. This one starts in my backyard. I have these 3 apricot trees. They're 3 different varieties. I can pick apricots for much of the summer, and I make jam. So in the winter of 2014, I went outside in early January, and these trees were blooming. And I thought, geez, this has never happened before. This is 3 weeks early, a bloom. You know, what to call this new season? And so I wasn't sure what to make of it. And I watched the trees, those little flowers, then turn into green nubs. And the trees look loaded. I was going to have a lot of fruit. And I even started counting up my mason jars because I like to make some sun jam out of those apricots. One day I go out in early spring to talk to my apricot trees. I have fruit trees all over. And they suddenly appeared weightless. There was nothing left on the trees. And I looked at the ground, and there were hundreds, if not thousands, of green nubs just sitting in a pile at trunk's feet. And it was like a mass shedding. I'd never seen that before. So I called up my buddy, Brad Gleason. He happens to farm 10,000 acres of nuts on the west side of Fresno County. And he always indulges me. He likes, you know, I'll tell him about what's going on in my little backyard farm, and he'll pretend that that's, you know, something that's real. So he says, I said, Brad, I can't explain something. All my apricots are gone. He said, I'm going to drive by, pick you up. I'm going to show you my orchards. So we drive out to the west side to his pistachio orchards. A pistachio orchard is a strange thing. First of all, it's like almost industrial in the way it's been planted and grooved. There is one male pistachio for every 24 female pistachios. And the farmer has a kind of perverse sense of humor. He paints the trunk of the male pistachio a rooster red color. So he grabs a stick, and there are these hanging pods of pollen off the males, and he hits the pods, and no green dust is coming off. I said, what are you doing? He said, the females are ready, okay, to be pollinated, but the males are nowhere near. I've never seen my orchard this out of sync. And I said, well, what is it? And he said, it's, you know, it's, and he uttered 3 words that that most farmers don't care to utter in the Central Valley, and that was global climate change. And so there was a connection, indeed, between my apricots in my backyard and his 10,000 acres of nuts. We had not had enough chilling hours in winter to put the trees to sleep. And my apricot tree needed to know kind of the death of winter to be able to create life in spring. And the same with his pistachios. Now, he had a solution that I didn't have. Later that day, there were these three-wheelers riding up and down his orchards. They had these blowers like a gardener would have on the back end, and they were blowing artificial male pollen that had been harvested earlier into the waiting limbs of these females. And he said, we'll see if they're keen. And they were keen, because he ended up getting a record crop that year, all through artificial insemination.
Wow. So water figures into this story too, because at some point Brad gets on the phone looking for water. Which not being in the agriculture business myself, not living in California, it is just kind of a does not compute there. How do you get on the phone and look for water?
So later that afternoon, we drove out to where the farmland gives way to pure desert, and Brad was punching a hole in the ground nearly 2,000 feet deep looking for more groundwater. And then he was on a phone with a water broker seeing if he could get some more Sacramento River water coming through the delta into the aqueduct and down through the west side of Fresno County into his canals. So much of this book looks at the growth of California, the growth of suburbia, and the growth of the farm belt. And what you see is in the early development of the farm belt, well, I guess we'd have to go back to second to the supercharged way California began, which is the gold rush. Mm-hmm. The mining of gold is really the mining of water first. And the first systems, the first hydraulic systems were invented, in the gold rush. And California in the 1880s had a choice. The gold mining, the hydraulics of it, were melting away the mountains, and the mountains then were silting up the rivers, and they were covering up the early farmland in the alluvial plains of those rivers. And California had this choice. Were we going to mine gold, or were we going to mine soil? And so in the 1880s, we decide we're going to mine soil. And the very industrialists who made the most money off of gold, they were living on Nob Hill in San Francisco. They become the great planters of wheat in the middle of California. And no one was bigger than a guy named Isaac Friedlander. Physically, he stood 6'7", weighed 300 pounds. He was the wheat king. And he had these clipper ships that would take the wheat from the middle of California and take them all the way to Liverpool, where Europe went crazy over California wheat. It was called white velvet. But that planting of 1 million acres of wheat, a monoculture robbed from the soil. So California had another choice. If we're going to farm, shouldn't we be farming the specialty crops that can't be farmed anywhere else? And so you see in the late 1800s, the early 1900s, this turn to fruits, vegetables, and nuts. And you see the selling of the California myth, the Washington Naval Orange, for instance, which sells Los Angeles. So we're farming those alluvial plains with the flow of the rivers and the snowmelt. At some point in the 1920s, when my grandfather arrives from Armenia, we invent the turbine pump, and it allows us to go into the ground. And what you see is the footprint of agriculture move then from the most primo land to more marginal land, because now they can pump the water out of the ground. If you fast forward to today, that footprint is grown even more, because we have this thing called drip irrigation. And those drip irrigation lines can go uphill. So now you're seeing nuts planted in places that nuts were never planted before, on hillsides. And you're seeing nuts planted in ground that is not even marginal, it's actually poor, because that drip irrigation line can deliver a precise dose of water to the root zone and the chemicals it needs. So you're literally growing almonds in soil that cattle doesn't even belong on. And so we've seen the footprint of agriculture go beyond sustainable. And now we're pumping so much water out of the ground to make up for the shortfall in drought that our land is sinking, not by inches, but by feet. And what's sinking along with the land are the canals and the aqueduct and all the infrastructure of that hydraulic irrigation. It's costing Californians right now hundreds of millions of dollars in extra electrical costs to push the water from Northern California to Southern California down the aqueduct, because the aqueduct relies on gravity, and we've lost the gravity flow.
Because the land has subsided. We're talking to Mark Arix about his book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California, an examination in a very literary form of what goes on with California and water, past, present, and near future. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I should point out the book is illustrated, so when you talk about the hydraulic giants washing away mountainsides in search of gold, we see those pictures. We also see a picture of Joe Poland and his markers on a utility pole. What was he demonstrating there?
Joe Poland was a geologist for the USGS, and for 40 years he was measuring the subsidence, the sinking of the land in the middle of California. No one was paying attention. So he decides at the end of the career, of his career, that he's going to turn this subsidence, this inch-by-inch sinking, into a drama. So he goes out to the west side, not far from where Brad's farm was, ranch, and Joe Poland finds a telephone pole, and he marks it in three places. Okay, he marks it in the 1930s or 40s, the 1950s or 60s, and then the present, 1977, 50 years. And the length of that telephone pole, and it's a long one, is the amount, the feet of the sinking of the land in that time. It's a stunt right out of the old cartoon Ripley's Believe It or Not that used to appear in all the
right papers. I remember that well.
Yeah.
So it blew my mind at one point in the book, Mark, actually several places, but there's a sentence that contains the years of both droughts and floods, and there are many, many of each. And it leads me to question whether there's any surprise that in a state of extremes in moisture, you also get extremes of solutions.
Well, what I did early in the book is I wanted to demonstrate that the average is a lie in California. Okay, we go from extremes. We swing from drought and flood. The problem is there's this collective amnesia. No people forget drought faster than we do. And we're actually surprised when a drought visits us again, just the same way we're surprised when flood happens. And yet it's only in the midst of those extremes that we come to some, you know, solutions. I mean, low flow toilets came about in one drought. So we tend to get creative in our desperation to stave off the next drought or the next flood. So, I list all these years, and it's almost like, well, what year isn't a drought or a flood? The problem now is you know, we don't need climate change to make California a very volatile place. But now the havocs of climate change are going to, you know, fasten upon our own inherent kind of havocs of weather, and we're going to see things that we've never seen before. I just did a big magazine piece on Paradise, the town that was nearly burned off the map.
Yes,
and really explore the factors that led to that tragedy.
You write in the Dreamt Land about a congressional field hearing on water. This is coming from one of Devin Nunes' committees. He's still a congress member from the area around Fresno. He's got some interesting theories on water problems. What are they?
Devin Nunes believes that that California's water problems aren't created because of drought. He actually thinks that there's that the drought is a human-created condition, that Congress and the laws that we have in California that try to at least, you know, maintain some flow in the rivers and give water to the fish, he believes those laws have created this shortage. And he thinks that there's a conspiracy, he calls it a communist conspiracy, to deny the middle of California the water that it should have. You know, every place in California, as you said in the opening, kind of steals from the place just beyond its water. That stealing began with L.A. I mean, L.A. ran out of its one modest river, the L.A. River, by 1880s, and went 230 miles away to Owens to bring that water in. And that became a model. When the middle of the state, the farmers in my backyard started drying up in a drought in the 1920s, their pumps couldn't go low enough. They then stole from the Sacramento River. That was the whole, you know, beginnings of the Central Valley Project. Later on, other parts of the middle of California ended up taking more from the Delta in the State Water Project. The folks up in the Delta are kind of tired of giving their water to the rest of the state. And this is now what we're seeing here, these kind of hard-baked water wars that I kind of go into each region up and down and visit with those folks. I call them the tribes of the South, the Middle, and the North, trying to understand, you know, whose claim to water is more righteous.
Well, this gets into an interesting part of the book where Brad Gleason, back to your friend with the 10,000 acres of nut trees, gets an on-air call from some radio guys in L.A. What are they asking him about?
He called me up and said he's going on the Ken and John show, and I told him, please do not do that. I mean, these guys are kind of like these snarling dogs. They go after everybody. But he said, no, I want to tell the story of farming to the city. And how, you know, we're doing something, you know, worthy with this water. And they were loaded for bear for him. It was a disaster. At some point, they hung up the phone on him as he was trying to say that, you know, explain that, wait a second, yes, each almond takes a gallon of water to grow. But when you consider all the other crops, you'll see that it's similar figures. They hung up the phone on him, and they said that he was a nut and that he was constipated with almonds. So it did not go well for Brad.
Wow. Okay. But
but you know, those guys were living. I mean, they were their radio show was from Burbank, which, you know, was living on borrowed water itself. So.
Well, which gets us to the city versus agriculture argument, which you apparently find more than a little irony in there.
Yeah, I mean, it's very tough for the city, especially a city that has taken its water from Owens, from the Colorado, from the Sacramento, to lecture a farmer who's taking the water from beneath him. Okay, now, that taking, that extraction, that culture of extraction has all sorts of consequences, and it's just not sustainable. But the water is beneath him. L.A., I don't think, is in a position to be lecturing anybody about, you know, the taking of water.
So you mentioned a couple of names already, Isaac Friedlander among them. Does the California attitude toward water, in other words, the people won't move, so the rain does that attitude have a founder, a first diverter, or a first dammer, or a similar figure?
Well, I think the first diverter was Henry Miller. Henry Miller came from Germany, became a butcher in New York City, and then the gold rush happened in California, and like the rest of them, he came out But he didn't head into the hills with a donkey. He decided that he was going to serve meat to the camps. So he becomes a butcher in San Francisco, the second largest butcher, and he decides he wants to vertically integrate. So he teams up with the largest butcher, a guy named Lux, and they end up starting this empire called Miller and Lux. And they grow the cattle, and where do they go to grow it? In the middle of California. Henry Miller starts buying up the land along these rivers. And in a sense, he owns the water flow because he owns the riparian rights to those rivers. And it was said that Miller could ride his horse from the border of Mexico to the border of Canada and never spend a night on land that wasn't his. So literally, he owned 1 million acres, controlled maybe 5 to 10 million more, and had this empire of cattle up and down the middle of the state. And he controlled the flow of the San Joaquin River and the Kern River. So he is our first guy who's really controlling the flow of rivers to create agriculture.
When you go looking for the San Joaquin...
There are characters like him. The book moves, the book starts in present day. It moves to history to show that this culture of extraction, how it began, and then it comes back into present day as I'm on the land with the new kings of California, and no one is bigger than Stuart Resnick. Stuart Resnick came to California to reinvent himself in the 1950s from New Jersey, landed at UCLA Law School, became a major businessman, and decided in the 1970s that to diversify, he needed to buy farmland in the middle of the state. So he ends up buying hundreds of thousands of acres, or tens of thousands of acres. It adds up to about 150,000 in the middle of California. Today, he is the biggest grower of pistachios, almonds, mandarins, and pomegranates in the world. Palm Wonderful, that the pomegranate juice, that's his. Fiji water happens to be his. He and his wife Linda control more water. They own more water, if you could own such a thing, than any couple in the state of California.
And as I read that section of the book, I was, how did they get their water? Was the question that was nagging the whole time?
Yeah. So the Resnicks live in Beverly Hills. And they farm in the middle of California in a place called Lost Hills. Those two places could not be more different. And really, he's like a modern-day Friedlander, where he's living in the city in luxury and then farming afar into the hinterlands. In Western Kern, it's a very strange place. There's no river running through it, so you can't tap into river's flow. There's not even any groundwater. The west side of Kern County, where most of his orchards are, relies wholly on the flow of the aqueduct as it goes through from, you know, it moves water from Mount Shasta all the way to San Diego. But in 3 years of the drought, the aqueduct wasn't delivering any water to his farm. So as I was driving out in the middle of this, you know, just row after row, acre after acre, square mile after square mile of his farmland, I couldn't figure out how he was hanging one record crop after another on his trees. And that becomes another mystery that drives the reader through this story. You know, how is he surviving? And that's when I find this secret pipeline that is moving water from three counties away onto his fields. So that's part of it. The other thing is he's spending tens of millions of dollars buying water from wherever he can from these brokers. And so that is a journey. It's the longest chapter in the book, through the Land of Wonderful. That's what they call their empire.
Right, the whole Palm Wonderful thing. Yeah, there's a great shot of the landing strip and for airplanes in the middle of the ranch that just says wonderful on it up to the sky.
Yeah, no, it's a land that's farmed. It's farmed from above as well, and that landing strip is incredible. I mean, it goes right through these orchards, and painted in white on it is wonderful.
So, Mark, I asked about a first diverter, and you gave the name of Henry Miller. Was there a first warner that you could find in California history, a first person to warn, you know, we can't keep moving water all these hundreds of miles without having some costs incurred, some difficulty to the landscape, some issues with sustainability, which I know wasn't a phrase back then?
There was no environmental movement to push back against the building of the Central Valley Project. In the State Water Project, you know, it was going to destroy these salmon runs that were ancient. You know, there were no native Californians, none of the indigenous around to warn us when these systems were being built. So you did have some Cassandras. One was a professor at the University of California at Berkeley named Harding, who in the 1920s, was hired by the state to try to figure out, you know, the water situation and whether or not it made sense to build a Central Valley Project to move the rain from north to south. And Harding warned that if we were going to do this, we had to make sure that we were farming the best land, that the footprint of agriculture, the more water you gave, inherent in that, was the more the farmer was going to reach into the horizon to grow even more crops and more crops. And he warned against this whole growth ethic, that the more you give, the more you're going to need to give. And like most Cassandras, he wasn't listened to. But his warning resonates on the land today. That's the situation we're in.
Mr. Harding, Dr. Harding, reviled in his time for his findings?
No, he was respected. I mean, he wasn't, you know, when you read his writings, he wasn't burning up the page. He was pretty judicious in what he was saying, and he wasn't trying to, you know, outrage farmer or the state or anything else. But you could see in you know, almost reading between the lines, this kind of warning. And then there was an actual warning. So no, he was not reviled. But he's proven correct. I mean, look what happened. We look at California as one of the most overregulated states in the country, but it's taken us 165 years to regulate the taking of groundwater. We're one of the last states to do so. And what's going to happen if that state law, and it's 20-year run-up to it, okay, they're now coming up with the sustainable models, each of these basins that are overdrafted. And so what will happen is if the state holds the locals feet to the fire, you're going to see the San Joaquin Valley, which is 6 million acres of farmland alone, it could go down to 4.5 million, 4 million, 5 million. We don't know yet, but it's going to be a significant, you know, cutback in farming. And that is to try to get, you know, things sustainable again. So we're going to see, you know, some changes happening now that Harding warned us about.
500 pages into the book, The Dreamt Land, you introduce us to someone you call the Oracle. Obviously, you can't tell us the person's real name, but what's this person's story?
Oh, the Oracle's had so many people writing, calling, talking to him. They've all figured him out. So yes, he said I can reveal his name, but he's this incredible farmer named Dennis Prosperi, a genius, who was able to distill for me this kind of growth ethic of California that leads to just more and more taking. And so I'm on the land with him in a place called Madera, California, and we're driving through all this farmland, much of it added in the wake of this historic drought. And I look at him and I say, how, you know, when the groundwater law comes into effect, how much of this land is going to be here? He says, well, you know, half of the stuff we've driven through needs to go fallow. We don't have the water to take this land into the future. But what's happened is we're having hedge funds and pension funds from New York and Florida come here and invest in these nuts. And they're looking at a 10-year model. If they can extract enough water in 10 years, they'll make the profits they need, 15-20%, to make, you know, their shareholders happy. And the Oracle has decided to get out of farming after three generations of farming that soil. He's taken his money and he's invested it in Boise, Idaho, in commercial property. So this is the sea change we're seeing here.
And you and Dennis discuss a list of ideas for making smarter use of water in California. What are some of the elements of the list, and are some of these being taken seriously now?
Well, there is a crop that probably California can't afford to grow anymore, and that's alfalfa. Mm-hmm. Alfalfa is a real water guzzler. And the cows that we're feeding this alfalfa to, these mega dairies, they probably have to leave California at some point. They started in Southern California. Then they sold out to developers back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. They came up and over the mountain to the middle of California. They knew that their time here was limited as well because they're sitting on the most fertile farmland in the world. And it's just, you know, when you can grow these specialty crops and sell them for the kinds of prices you can, you know, creating surplus milk doesn't pencil out. So we're going to have to get rid of our dairies, okay? I say that, and it's going to offend all my Azorean, Portuguese, and Dutch dairy friends, but they're going to have to go to a place that makes cows truly happy, maybe Colorado, New Mexico. We're going to have to shrink the footprint of agriculture back to something that's more sustainable. How many more people can we take? You know, we right now in California, we have 10 million people living in the wildland-urban interface, right in the path of wildfire. And that's what happened up in Paradise. It wasn't just a little mountain community that grew there. They took a chunk of L.A. and transplanted it onto a ridge that was kind of a geologic chimney. 40,000 people were living up there in the path of wildfire. So California is going to have to come up against this reality of a limit line. And something is going to have to give. And that's the era we're in now, an era where climate change is going to hook, you know, link up to our own crazy weather, and we're going to confront these things. And when will it, we decide that, hey, we've got to draw a line around the farm belt, a line around suburbia, and say no more. That's where we're at.
Are these lessons more easily learned in years when there is an active drought, unlike now, for example?
Yeah, we're talking right now about growing a couple million affordable houses, and the question is, into what safe zone are we going to put these houses? So, you know, we'll just have to wait for the next drought, for the next desperation to set in, and maybe some solutions will come out of that.
Well, extremes of water in California, extremes of dealing with water in California over the years, well reflected in the book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. It's the work of Mark Arix. Thank you so much for joining us on The Exchange today.
Jeff, I appreciate it. You clearly read the book. I appreciate that. Thank you so much for having me on.
Pleasure's mine.